Welcome to Time to Talk Science and Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Dr. Charlie Highmarch, and I'm an assistant professor and researcher at Queen's.
And my name is Stephen Archer, and I'm a cardiologist and researcher, and also the director of the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's, which we call TIME.
In this series, we're fortunate to talk science and medicine with some of the most accomplished translational researchers from Queen's University and beyond. We want to know what their dangerous idea, which is a concept that they're working on, which if true, would change the direction of research as they know it. But we also want to find out a little bit more about the person behind the discoveries. In previous podcasts, we've sat down with clinicians and basic scientists from Queen's and beyond to discuss a diverse range of research topics, ranging from cancer research to studies of cardiovascular disease, bleeding disorders, and the impact of animal care on human and animal well-being. We've even discussed particle physics with a Nobel laureate and healthcare reform with a former dean.
Today, we turn our thoughts to the current state of the medical profession in Canada with a focus on how we train doctors and whether the way we do it currently is the best way to meet society's healthcare needs or even to train healthy, happy doctors. We have the great pleasure of having my friend, Dr. Tony Sanfilippo, with us today. Dr. Sanfilippo is a cardiologist. He also has served our community in Ontario as the Associate Dean for Undergraduate Education at Queen's for over 15 years. He's also an advisor for innovation and expansion in our medical school. Importantly, though, for today, he's published a book, which I've actually read, so that's a good start, called The Doctors We Need, and it's available in all good bookstores. Rather than dealing with the symptoms of the shortage of primary care physicians, the book highlights the underlying causes for the problem. Why don't we have the doctors we need? In this book, Dr. Sanfilippo guides us through the Byzantine process by which we currently train doctors, discusses the challenges of training adequate numbers of family doctors, and notes we have a system in which there's no clear link between how we train doctors and how many doctors we train versus society's need for doctors. So, Tony, thank you for coming on our podcast today. But before we get into your book, which we're fascinated to talk about, I'd like to ask you about your origin story. How did the famous Dr. Sanfilippo emerge?
Well, thank you for this interview today. I appreciate being here. My origin story, I don't get asked that very often, but I'm a first-generation Canadian. My father immigrated to Canada shortly after the Second World War. He met my mother here, who's also first-generation Canadian. My grandparents are all from the same village in Sicily. And I don't have a background in medicine or in higher education, but like many, many others, my parents worked hard to give us the opportunity to become educated and to find our way in the world. And my dad built a business that still operates in Collingwood, Ontario. One of my brothers operates it. And we all worked in that business, my siblings and I. Out of that, we all went on to various careers thanks to my parents. I grew up in a small town. Collingwood at that time was only 8,000 people. So everybody knew everybody else. And there was a real sense of community. The major activities there were shipbuilding at that time. Not tourism as it is now, and farming. And so I grew up around folks who were very much family-oriented, were very much community-oriented, who worked hard to support their families. I think that sense of community has really stuck with me.
And I think your family business, was that in the produce?
My dad sold wholesale fruits and vegetables to stores and restaurants in the region, and the business still does in the Georgian Bay Area.
So how do you get from doing a produce business, working there, driving a truck, and which I think you also did for your dad, and even bricklaying?
Yeah, I did some. Yeah, I had a number of jobs outside my family business, including masonry and laying bricks and working in construction, yeah.
So how did that set you up for your trip to Queen's University to become a physician?
Well, it became obvious early in life that I was not a business person. I didn't want to work, but I didn't have the business sense that my father and brother did. But I did have an interest in medicine, and as a child, I had a lot of allergies, and those allergies took me to the doctor's office once a week. to get allergy shots and treatments. And in those days, what I did, I just walked into the office and waited my turn. And the nurse who worked there, Martha, who was a lovely, lovely lady, would fit me in between things and give me my shots or whatever. And I got to see how the office worked. And after a while, she let me sit in her office and just wait there, because I had to wait after my injection as well for 20 minutes. So I was there for a long time, and I got to see how the office worked. She was very kind to me. I got to know the doctor. And I just felt like this was an environment where I could do something.
So this is the virtue when we have our patients sit and endlessly wait for us. They may actually be auditioning for a career in medicine.
There's a virtue to waiting and watching.
So you come to Queen's University, and I would imagine you're highly sophisticated coming from a small town. I know I came from Hampton, New Brunswick, and was amazed by the size of Kingston, Ontario, and the heights of the buildings. So were you comfortable coming to Queen's, or was it a big change?
My first couple of years were difficult. I mean, I enjoyed the people I was living with, but the university environment and the city, and to me, it was a city. You know, I know to most of our students coming from Toronto, Kingston seems like a small place, but to me, it was a big place. And the academic life in early university with the large classes I was in, I was not the best environment for me. So I struggled with the academics. I did okay. I got good marks. I passed my courses. I got reasonable marks, but I didn't excel and I wasn't comfortable. And it wasn't until the classes started getting smaller and I developed an interest in physiology, and physiology was great because it was small classes and lots of tutors and lots of professors and like-minded students. And it was then that I kind of really got comfortable with the whole learning and science process.
So to get into medical school now, people write MCAT exams, and they often take MCAT preparation courses, and they volunteer around the world doing all kinds of noble acts. How did you actually go from being an undergrad at Queen's to applying for medical school? How did that happen?
Well, I learned the process through my classmates and other folks, but I wasn't initially successful. I didn't get in when I first applied, and you know, my marks were okay, but they weren't great, and I didn't have much of a resume really. Once I didn't get in, I learned it was important to talk to the admissions dean. And at that time, the admissions dean was Dr. Einarsson. So I went to talk to him. And I was sort of expecting a grilling. But instead, I found a very kindly gentleman who just wanted to know me and just asked me about myself and my background, kind of like we're talking about now. At the end, he thanked me, and I said, well, do you think I should keep applying? He didn't answer the question, but what he said was, don't worry, I know you well.
It sounds very ominous. It didn't know whether that was good or bad.
I didn't know whether that was good or bad. But I did get on the waiting list the following year and got into medical school. And I think that's largely Dr. Einarsson's doing.
I think things have changed an awful lot in the admissions process, because I think if any undergraduate students right now who are hoping to go into medical school were to hear this story, they'd probably kind of think that maybe the route has become far more complicated for them to get in. I think recent findings from the US suggest that up to 70 or 80% of physicians in training have at least one parent at home who's also a physician. So obviously that's a stark contrast to your admissions experience. How do you think this plays out for the future of kind of education and admissions of physicians?
Well, there's no question the admissions process has changed. The fundamental characteristics have been in place for a long time, including when I applied, but they've all become greatly accentuated and expanded by the tremendous pressure on medical school admissions. The number of applicants vastly outstrips the number of positions that are being offered, such that the competition is very much heightened, and students are becoming very, very aware of the process and the steps they should take to enhance their likelihood of admission. And I've tried to outline that to some extent in a book, but I think the effect that has had has been to detract us away from the attributes and the ability to identify the attributes that that characterize the individual who is most likely to succeed and to be happy in a career in medicine. And it moves us towards an environment where folks who have resources, have support, have some inside knowledge are vastly have a great advantage in terms of their ability to get in. And so folks from those backgrounds and from more economically advantaged backgrounds do have a head start in this process. Now, that's not to say that folks from medical families don't make great doctors. They do. But so do folks from non-medical families and from all backgrounds. And we need people from a diversity of backgrounds in medicine. So I think our process, as I've said in the book, needs to go back to its roots, and our applicants need to as well. They need to think about what doctors actually do and whether these are careers that are really suited for them.
So as we creep towards talking about your book, maybe I think for those of us that live in the medical world, it's hard to imagine not knowing about how doctors are selected and trained and what likelihood they have to go on if they get into medical school to become a practicing doctor. And how does that relate to the supply of doctors in society? So it's a bit of a big question, but as we try to weave those two lines together, the doctors that ultimately practice versus the people we take in to become doctors, like how many people are applying to Queen's? Do they all become practicing doctors? Do they get to pick what they want to do? So many questions, Tony.
Okay. Well, the process in its fundamental nature hasn't changed in decades. And the key component to what you're talking about is the entry to the profession. And the entry of the profession functionally is the entry to medical schools. Because no one practices medicine without a medical degree. Medical degrees are the purview of universities, university-based medical schools. And the criteria by which those admission processes are carried out are individual to those schools, their admission committees. There is no sort of common accepted paradigm about how this should be done, although there are commonalities in the methodologies across the different schools. The other side of that is that almost everybody who comes into medical school becomes a doctor. The attrition rate from medical school is about less than 2%. So 98% or so of people who get into medical school, find their way to the practice of medicine. But as medicine has expanded in terms of its specialties, it's now to one of over 130 different types of medicine. And in order to engage those, folks have to engage extra training after medical school. Decades ago, a medical degree was a license to practice medicine, basically. People went out and practiced after they got their degree or a year or two of training. Now, of course, specialties require additional training that has been tacked on to the end. So the functional outcome of all this is that medical school entry is the portal by which the medical profession is staffed, by which society's medical needs are met. Those criteria are based on the ability of a small committee that makes its own decisions in its university to deal fairly. And these folks are struggling to do a fair job, deal fairly with the glut of applications that they get. And the easiest way to do that, in the way that all schools use, is to start with academic accomplishment and whatever quantitative data they can acquire. And so GPAs are quantitative, they're numerical, they're easy to justify. MCATs, where they're used, are also quantitative, and they can be stratify applicants. So they are a means of taking that large number of applicants and getting them into a number that can be looked at with greater scrutiny. And so students know this. And of course, students therefore feel and justifiably feel incredible pressure to accomplish academically. And they're able to find courses, methodologies, assistance to make sure that their GPAs and their marks are competitive. And the more resources you have, the more know-how you have, the better you are at doing that. The same holds true of the MCAT. The MCAT is still used by many, many schools. And there are numerous ways to learn how to do the MCAT and to get better at it. And you can do it multiple times, right?
Just for our audience, what's the MCAT?
The Medical College Admission Test, which is a test of background science and, to some extent, aptitude for medical practice that is run by an agency in the United States that is offered at multiple sites across the United States and Canada. Costs significant amounts to take, but costs even more to prepare for because folks take courses. In fact, you can go off for 2 weeks and, you know, take courses in how to do best in the MCAT. So there's an incredibly competitive environment that is academically marks-based. And the other side of this is that, folks are choosing courses based on the marks that those courses offer. And so, unfortunately, people are moving away from courses they might want to take because they can't get the same marks as they would in another course. If you take a science course, a math course, you can get a very, very high mark. If you take philosophy, forget it, right? Nobody's going to take a course where the average mark is, or the highest mark is like the mid-80s. They want to take a course where the highest mark is 99. And they know that. That's all out there.
Yeah, and certainly as somebody who's engaged in, I guess, preclinical education, I teach undergraduates science, and we see not only a problem of grade inflation, where all of the candidates for medical school and 90% of these students want to go to medical school, they all try and jostle in the high 90s. So it's very difficult for us to differentiate them from each other because they're all stellar students. But also that there's the phenomenon of bird courses, where courses you can fly through. There's websites that will allow you to select the path of least resistance, the minimum number of steps required to maximize your grades. And this presumably is all part of the same problem.
Yeah. We're not offering the URL for our listeners for the bird course. But there's like 4,000 or so people apply every year to Queen's for 100. Well,
Queen's
or so.
Gets more than that.
Okay. What are the numbers?
Queen's gets several thousand.
Yeah.
Queen's is one of the more highly applied to schools in the country, but every school gets thousands of applicants.
So thousands of people apply. We take in 100 or so.
Queen's takes in a little over 100, yeah, but there are about 3,000 offered across Canada.
And then 4 years later, out comes 98% of those same people, at least, and then they go on and apply to residencies. And so using your own career as a cardiologist, how many years is it from the time they came to Queen's from Collingwood to the time you're a cardiologist?
So the stages are, once you're in medical school is in Canada, usually 4 years. There are a couple of 3-year schools, but generally 4 years. At the end of medical school, students are not really qualified to do anything other than enter a residency program. And there are 30 entry-level residencies that students apply through. So these same students that applied and worked so hard to get into medical school very quickly find themselves in another competitive application process for these specialties. And there are 30 of these specialties, 30 or so entry-level specialties that students go in through a particular matching process. One of those is family medicine. Once they're in those entry-level specialties, many of those specialties then subspecialize further. So internal medicine, which Steve and I both came through, and surgery, you come into the general program in pediatrics. And then after 2 or 3 years of the general program, you branch into another secondary residency. Now, what's emerged is that as special skills develop in areas like cardiology and gastroenterology and such, there is further training required. So my particular training, I went through medical school, and then I went into cardiology, and then internal medicine, and then cardiology. And then in cardiology, I developed an interest in what was the field of imaging that was emerging at that time. So I did a 2-year further fellowship in imaging in Boston. So the number of stages, admissions is a stage. I consider admissions a stage of medical education. Undergraduate medical education is stage two. Stage three is primary residency. Stage four is secondary residency. And then there's what we call fellowship. And then for everybody, there's a period of practice adjustment. You know, there's a period in when you're fully qualified, but you know, and you're able to practice. But there's a period, it's not official, but there's a period of time when people are finding their way in whatever environment they're taking their skills to.
So you leave Collingwood, and in about 8 years, you're Dr. Sanfilippo, and then in about eight more years, you're Dr. Sanfilippo, the cardiologist. But it's interesting, as a hockey player, this 98% graduation rate, which I'm not in principle against, but the reality is we're now expecting this team of hockey players to go out and staff a hockey team with the rules that they pick their own position on the team and none of them can be discharged. So we're trying to assemble. So how do we make sure, if we think about, as your book discusses, the shortage of family physicians, and no one is either forcing or encouraging or hopefully discouraging people from being family doctors versus exologists, how does this hockey team eventually assemble itself, considering that they started off as kids from Collingwood and just picked their own position on the team?
Well, that's exactly the dilemma. And I think it's forcing us into two uncomfortable decisions and changes that we have to really engage seriously. And one is that I don't think it's any longer reasonable or practical to expect that we are going to take in folks who got a very vague idea of wanting to become a doctor, but no idea of what kind of doctor they're going to be. On the other hand, it's also unreasonable to expect that they're going to have enough knowledge to pick from the 130 or so specialties that we need, you know? So how to do this? Well, it requires, I think, some graduated decision-making. And I think we're at a point where we have to expect that our people coming in are going to have some idea of what kind of doctor they want to be, not in terms of the specific subspecialty, but more generally in terms of whether they want to be family doctors, whether their particular interest is diagnostics and internal medicine, surgery, mental health, pediatrics. Family medicine is a great place to start, if you will, because it is such a need right now. It's such a critical need. And the characteristics of folks who engage generalist care, holistic care, continuing care of their patients differentiates from those who are engaging patients for the purpose of treating a particularly already diagnosed illness. Those are different people, those are different approaches, and all the specialties vary in terms of their involvement in both. None are devoid of both, but it's clear that specialties like family medicine are much more engaged in what I call generalist care, holistic care, continuing care. And those are different fundamental people. They're different interests. They're different strengths. They're different attitudes than folks who are going to deal with more, much more specific things. The doctor who takes care of a population of people in a small community and takes care of all of them in his or her group, regardless of what happens to them, regardless of where they are in life, that's a different human being than the person who is interested and who is looking after a highly specific thing, like, you know, doing surgery on the eye or doing highly specific cardiac interventions that we're familiar with. We need them both, right? The book's called The Doctors We Need, but I can tell you, we need all the doctors we have, and we need more as specialties emerge and as new needs emerge. One of the stories in my book was about a gentleman who presents after the age of 90 with a heart valve problem. And today we're able to offer patients like that practical, safe solutions to that, where 20, 30 years ago, that wasn't the case. So and that's wonderful, but that's another job. That's a whole nother specialty. We need people trained doing that. So we need many more doctors than we're currently providing, but we need, and across a wide variety of things. Family medicine is the obvious upfront need right now.
So your talk of specialization is a perfect segue into my next question. I want to turn my attention to your new book, which is entitled The Doctors We Need, Imagining a New Path for Physician Recruitment, Training, and Support. Can you tell us why you wrote this book? Do we not already have the doctors we need? I'm really wanting to focus on a sketch of the medical landscape in Canada in 2025 in terms of doctor shortages.
So I wrote the book. The book emerged out of 15 or 16 years of work in medical schools and working with our medical school here at Queen's, but also with very closely with the leaders of schools across the country. Seeing what struggles were emerging in the education, admission, education, and subsequent training of students as they came in and then went on to become doctors. These issues around admissions, around training, around the lack of connection between what we're doing in medical school and what society needs became obvious to me. I lived in two worlds. I live in the world of medical education, which is university-based, which is based on decisions made in smaller, usually small groups in isolation of the overall environment. And I also live in the world of healthcare, where I see the needs that patients are having. And I try to describe some of those in the book. And my two worlds, I weren't connecting. They were running in parallel. You know, I work in both, but I work in parallel in both. And they're clearly interconnected in that, you know, learners are involved in delivery of healthcare. Healthcare is supplemented by learners. They work in parallel, but they're not connected. The university-based world and the worlds of all of these smaller groups that are involved in the process of training doctors is isolated from the needs of society. The society is crying out for more family doctors and it needs more doctors in general. There's no connection back to the pipeline. And the book was written with the idea of clarifying that deficiency and talking about some of those causes. And I used deliberately stories of patients and doctors to illustrate it, because I think that's what brings it to life. And frankly, my background as a teacher is based on, you know, telling stories and talking about cases and talking about examples. And so the book is written with that in mind. But we have, a desperate deficiency of communication within our system. We have many, many organizations involved in the process of educating doctors, but there's no oversight to it. It's kind of like the old, you know, parlor game of telephone, you know, where you know, someone whispers a message to someone, that person whispers it to someone else, and it goes around the room. Everybody involved is well-intentioned. Everybody in good faith is trying to be reliable to that message. But by the time it gets to the end, it's completely garbled. It's completely different. And it's only because no one is paying attention along the way. Everybody's doing their job. Everybody's passing it off to the next person. But no one's stopping and saying, hey, what are we doing overall? What's the real message? And are we really achieving the real message? And if we're not, then where do we need to change?
I think you make a nice case in the book for, in the business world, supply and demand are intrinsically linked in order to maximize efficiency. And of course, that's not well, the relationship's broken, and presumably it's because of the size of the machine that's working to take undergraduate students and turn them into specialized physicians.
Yeah. So, yeah, in the world, if there's a demand, it's met, right? We've got lots and lots of examples where you know, public demand for a resource, whether it's a luxury or a necessity, sparks a response, and it gives rise to a response to meet that need. We're not seeing that in this process. And of course, you know, why? Well, there's not an economic link between them, right? There isn't a sense that these two things need to be linked. But we are starting to see a little bit of it in that there are health resources available to people today as a result of this crisis that weren't there a few years ago and are expanding.
I guess the lag time that it takes for the product, the student, to go through university is kind of part of the problem, because by the time you get to 8 to 12 years of training, the kind of the feedback that the environment has changed completely in a decade.
Yeah, it is for sure. There's just no question that what I'm proposing in this book is not a quick fix, right? It isn't something that's going to fix this tomorrow. There's maybe another book on things that we can do to help fix this tomorrow. But my point is that unless we deal with the structural change, this is going to be a continuing issue, and it's going to be an expanding issue, because every year more doctors are retiring. Hmm. And the population's getting bigger. The health needs, the technologies available, the treatments available are expanding. Unless we grapple with the foundational issue here, and accept that it's going to take a little time for it to come into play, unless we begin to grapple with that, this is not going to go away. It's going to get worse.
So this reminds me, excuse me, it's cold season here at Queens. This reminds me of two things. One is the adage to follow the money. And the second is, I've seen the enemy and it is us. So on follow the money, we could just train more doctors, but we're not in control of that. That's the provincial government that decides how many medical school slots we have. And in terms of the enemy being us, doctors have become a scarce specialty in Canada. And for some doctors, that suits them fine. And so the part of the issue, I guess, is, you know, should we just have more doctors and accept the fact that not every doctor that's trained in medical school will be guaranteed a job? Because presumably, you know, if every doctor is called doctor, some are good, some are bad, and some are indifferent. So should we be training more doctors? And is that the problem? Because I think when it comes to hospital beds, a number of nurses, number of doctors, those are all government controlled ultimately. And I think the conventional wisdom, having lived half my life in the States and Canada, was our system was just fine, thank you. And we were training enough. We had enough beds, enough doctors, enough nurses. So how much is it a money government issue? And also, you know, to what extent do doctors insist on being fully employed forever, and therefore we only train one per spot?
Well, it's a bit of both. If I start with the funding side of it, you're quite right. If you follow the money, the funding of medical education is public. I mean, our provincial governments fund our medical schools to an extent beyond tuitions. I mean, folk, I know medical students pay tuition. They certainly do. They incur debt, but the bulk of medical education is funded through public sources, through our provincial governments. They also fund residencies. They fund the whole thing, much of the whole thing. They have the capacity, I believe, to, you know, and this is going to be controversial, but to be more prescriptive about the outcome they expect. Our provincial governments are representing the people who are not getting family doctors. They're using tax dollars that emanate from people who are not being served fully by the medical system. I think it's entirely in their right. In fact, I think it's their responsibility to say to the medical education process, hey, we expect some outcomes here in terms of the mix and number of doctors that we're producing. And to begin that dialogue, and I'll tell you, that could move things very quickly, because those dollars that come through are very influential in terms of what schools will do. The other side of it you're alluding to is the expectations of doctors. Can we imagine a time, even if we doubled or tripled the number of doctors that we have in Canada today, where there wouldn't be enough to do for the doctors that want to work and are willing to go out there and do things? And I'm having trouble even imagining that day, you know. But I can imagine a day when not everybody's going to be able to do specifically what they want to do, where they want to do it, when they want to do it. And I think as a profession, and again, this may not be popular, but I think that we're entering an age where we need to prioritize the needs of people we serve, at least on an equivalent with our own personal interests and preferences. So what's that mean? That means that we should be looking around for what's needed in our communities as opposed to just what we want to do, and be flexible in terms of how we provide it. That doesn't mean you can't have a wonderful career and have lots of flexibility. I mean, medicine it's just an incredible career in the sense of being interesting, of being rewarding, of being respected, but also of having flexibility about what you do. I mean, we have the capacity to work in various different clinical settings, doing different things, learn different things, to teach, to do research. I mean, it's an incredible privilege. And just recognizing that with that privilege goes a need to provide the services that are required of the people that we're serving, I think is something we're going to have to engage more avidly.
Yeah, I think it better be the medical profession that figures it out, because otherwise you wind up with a situation like Quebec where you're basically being told where you can practice and what type of doctor you'll be. And I think hopefully we'll figure that out. But enough about teasing that we're going to talk about the book. So we set this complicated stage that sort of inspired this book. But on this podcast, we like to ask our guests, what's their dangerous idea? So this dangerous idea, and I think you have multiple, but what's the sort of dangerous idea as pertains to the combination of the training of doctors and ultimately provision of the doctors we need?
If I could, there's three.
Okay.
There's three.
Only because you're a friend. Usually
well, there's more.
Our Nobel laureate only had one dangerous idea, Tony, but we'll give you three.
There's more, but I'll, one is about admissions, right? I think we need to rethink how we admit people to medical school. And I think we have to expect our applicants to have a more rounded idea, fully rounded idea of what kind of doctor they want to be, and a more realistic idea about what medicine is. I think we've got to stop, you know, bringing in folks who are just academically very, very accomplished and have a general desire to be doctors, and ask them more specifically, what is it about medicine? What is it about your goals in life that match a career in medicine? You know, I think that there's two components to this. You know, there's wanting to become a doctor because it is a fulfillment of your personal desires, your personal interests. But there's also wanting to be a doctor because it is a way of helping the people around you. And I think we need folks who've got both those things. And when those come together, we've really got something. My second thing is that once you got those people, let's train them to what they want to do. You know, if we've identified people who have a particular desire, interest, aptitude, we believe, to become generalists and family doctors, or to become really great surgeons, or to become really great lab medicine people or mental health people, let's get them into training early on that's specific to that environment. And let's put them in places where they're going to work with folks who are doing it, and in work environments where they can do this. You know, I hear that, well, we don't have enough placements for this. Well, we don't have enough placements because we're trying to put everybody into everything, regardless of whether or not they're ever going to do it. I think if we go back and think about putting people into placements who are actually going to do those things, that dynamic will change. And thirdly, I think we need to really drastically rethink the environment in which particularly family doctors are working. And one of the chapters of my book, I talk about how the office-based environment that family doctors are largely working in doesn't allow them to practice to the full scope of what they're able to do, and puts on them administrative burdens and business issues and paperwork issues that are frankly soul-sucking and detract from their real job. We've got people who are spending time filling out forms rather than seeing the next patient. That's a travesty.
So, and feeding on from that travesty, as you know, I'm not a physician, but I work in the Department of Medicine as a cross-appointed faculty member. I have many colleagues who are medical professionals and many friends as well. So reading this book, I imagined I wouldn't necessarily learn too much about the medical educational landscape in Canada. I thought I kind of knew enough. In particular, I was shocked by the funding models in Canadian healthcare and the extra burden that that specifically applies and confers onto primary health. My question is, a member of the general public who hasn't got friends and colleagues who are doctors, what do you anticipate will be their biggest surprise when they read this book pertaining to the medical educational landscape?
Well, first of all, let me say, Charlie, that you're not alone. And if I have an advantage in terms of writing a book like that, it's because I've been at it a long time, like a very long time. And I've been involved in various aspects of this process along the way. So I've had an opportunity to kind of see it from different perspectives that most folks don't have that opportunity to do. I think folks reading this book, and they're already telling me, that they get insights about why the system is as it is that they didn't have before. And they honestly have some, I think, sympathy for the doctors that they're that are trying to provide care that they didn't have before, and some insights into that. I hope that translates into efforts on everyone's behalf to advocate for change, because this is not the kind of change that one person or one group is going to be able to make. It's going to have to come up from lots of different levels. And what I hope to do in this book is just raise that awareness and to allow folks to kind of see that all of us, in whatever capacity we are, whether it's as a admission committee member or a teacher in physiology or a clinical preceptor in a small town who's seen students from time to time, or a patient who's going to their clinic and is asked to, would you mind if a student sees you first? I hope everyone understands that the concept of medical education, we're all involved in it. And if I had a message for patients, I would say you're teachers too. You know, When a patient comes to hospital and sees a medical student or a medical student or a resident is involved in their care, that is an incredible learning opportunity. And that's a privilege that student is providing. It's a gift. And those encounters can have incredible effects on those learners. And so they're part of the process too. We're all part of the process of producing these doctors. Whether we're patients, whether we're administrators, whether we're politicians, whether we're teachers in medical school, whether we're doctors working in a small town on our own, we can all be part of that solution.
Yeah, it is interesting on your dangerous ideas, Tony. We're, of course, in the non-podcast world, we're actually friends in the real world and get together for breakfast, a group of five of us every week, and talk about the problems of the world and how to fix them. And we've often talked about medical student admissions and how, I mean, medicine is a lot of work. There's not a lot of applause. You do it behind a closed door and you look after people and you're taking shoes on, putting and off and examining people. A lot of it's not very sexy and there's no sort of medal at the end of the clinic. Maybe gratitude from the patient, and yet we're selecting people that have achievement upon achievement. And we've often talked about whether it would be better to pick more people that have laid some bricks, so to speak, and that have, you know, I remember there was a faculty member that fell right in front of KGH, and a bunch of students, not necessarily medical students, but in this real world story, walked right on by. And the kind of person that we want is the kind of person that when they see someone wipe out on the ice in front of the hospital, actually stops to help them. Because in the end, if you're not interested in that humanistic side of it, you will not like a career in medicine. And you may be smart enough by far to do the job, but you will be unhappy because a lot of it is little acts of kindness done in privacy and being diligent, not necessarily brilliant. And I don't know if you'd agree. I don't know how you make an admission criteria for that.
What you say is absolutely true. I mean, if I look back on my years in medicine, the people I've known, like you, and the many, many doctors and students that I've encountered along the way, I'm led to the conclusion that the greatest and most sustaining attribute is the capacity and the willingness to help others. There is a satisfaction, there is a sense of fulfillment that comes from the act of being able to help another individual, and it can be small ways or large ways. But there's something that comes with that is personal, that we receive in much greater quantity than we give. and for people who for whom that is the case, and there are many of them, many in medicine and applying to medicine. For those people, then their personal fulfillment in life and the needs of medical society go together hand in hand. They are one and the same. And those people will have sustained, happy careers. They tend not to have issues personally. And then, frankly, they have trouble retiring. And it's not because of the money. It's not because of the accolades or because they're being recognized as the greatest in the world. It's a personal sense of fulfillment. And our job as medical schools is finding those people and allowing them to show themselves and come forward from whatever background they come from. And they come from every background. They come from families that are well off, that have got lots of doctors. They come from families that are immigrants. They come from all different cultures, all different backgrounds. How do we find them? I think we go back to Dr. Einarsson, you know, and we talk to people personally, and their stories come out. The other thing practically we can do is that if we are providing education that is specific and directed towards a particular career outcome, then we're necessarily going to attract people who want to do that. So if we have this program now in Lake Ridge, in Oshawa, which is a family medicine specific program that is now in its second year. Now it is accepting applications and reviewing folks for a program that is 6 years that will result in them being ready to do family medicine. There is no decision in process within that. And so that is going to necessarily attract people who want to do family because it doesn't go anywhere else. So as we design our processes, we will change the admission dynamic as well. And that's a practical thing, right? People will select themselves. You won't go into a family medicine program if your interest and your skill and your aptitude is a highly specific specialty area.
Some of these reforms you lay out in your book were we would get more doctors in family medicine if we trained them de novo to be family doctors from the get-go, and also if their practice style was such that it was attractive. Because Dr. Philpott, who was our former dean who was on this show, wrote a book as well. We talked to her about the shocking fact in her book that only something like 20% or so of people that train in family medicine go on to do full-time family medicine, implying that that leak in the bathtub needs to be closed or we'll never fill the bathtub up with family doctors that we need. So I think there's a lot in the book, but and although I could go on, I'm going to pick your mind more at breakfast, but my last formal question is sort of the bump in the road story. And that is like run a medical school, you're a very successful physician, but I'm sure you've encountered some adversity. What bump in the road have you had that might inform others about the practice of medicine?
The biggest bump in the road was, you know, when I became the associate dean for the medical program at Queen's, and began working with the other associate deans from the other 16 schools at the time across the country. We all entered those jobs with the idea that we wanted to make a difference. We had ideas about medical education. We loved working with students. We wanted to help those students become the best doctors they could be. We had reforms in terms of what we wanted to do with curriculum. What we ran into were a large number of issues, largely much of which were related to accreditation issues, but on the ground, things that were messy and didn't have a lot to do with actually producing good doctors. the process for medical school accreditation, most folks don't know, but it's a very involved process, which we need. We need accreditation. We need scrutiny. We need to make sure that schools are doing a good job. But the process has become very, very detailed. It takes lots of resources, lots of time. It's highly distracting. It makes it difficult to make change because change has to be done within the context of the accreditation process. So I think the biggest bump in the road was having to deal with those kind of issues rather than the larger issues that we talked about in the book.
Yeah, and I do have to say for podcast people that may not be, listeners that may not be familiar with Dr. Sanfilippo, he led this medical school from being on the verge of not being accredited many years ago to being fully accredited, which is an impressive accomplishment. But when Tony enlisted me to help in a minor way in this at one point, I was shocked to see hundreds of criteria, of which dozens applied to what I would think make a good doctor, and many applied to things like lockers and space to store things and indebtedness and all things that are important but don't necessarily translate directly into whether you have good doctors coming out the other end. So I can imagine the frustrations.
Yeah, just to clarify one that we were never not accredited.
No.
But we had a lot of things we had to deal with.
Don't go all Richard Nixon on me. Yeah, no. I know you're not a crook.
And I got to tell you that's not unique to me. I mean, all of my colleagues across the country had to deal with accreditation issues, and it is the soul-sucking experience of being a medical education leader.
So in our conversations leading up to this podcast, you described something called the four-tier problem. I was particularly compelled by that. Would you mind articulating that for our audience, please?
Well, so what's emerging as a result of, partly as a result of the family medicine crisis, and partly result of the economic duress that our society is currently experiencing, as evidenced by food bank issues and homelessness and such, is this intersection of availability of family doctors and economic duress, such that we are effectively now living in a four-tiered world. And what I mean by that is that if you have a family doctor and have economic resources, you have available to you lots of options outside the public system to seek help if you feel, by virtue of the time that it's going to take or just personal preference, you want to get your help sooner or different. So you can now get diagnostic procedures across the border very quickly. You can fly to European countries to get your hip and cataracts done at some expense, over and above what you get in the public system. And this is not just the fabulously rich that are doing this. This is folks who've got some savings and are choosing to use those savings to prioritize their quality of life rather than other things. Now, if you have a family doctor but don't have that economic ability, you still get good health care, but you don't have those extra options available to you. If you don't have a family doctor but have some economic capacity, then you can now compensate for the lack of a family doctor by purchasing care either through online resources or through clinics that are emerging outside the public system. And recently in Quebec, you've probably heard that the doctors, as you mentioned earlier, are being maybe penalized for working in these systems because they're flocking to them. At the bottom of the pile, of course, are the folks who have the double whammy of not having a family doctor and don't have economic resources. Those folks are truly troubled. They can get acute care by going to Emerge, but if they have a non-acute problem or if they have a chronic problem, and certainly the idea of prevention and early diagnosis is way beyond them. So we effectively have this four-tier system, and it's growing. It's going to grow, and it's not evil. You know, it's they're providing good care. But it forces us to ask, are we going to let it just grow on its own in any way it will and let the market forces, as we talked about earlier, which are driving this, continue to drive it, which is one approach and is the default approach? Or are we going to ask the question, look, how can we help? How can we work it together? How can we use these resources that are going into this public private system and use it to ensure that everybody gets better care. The arguments, of course, are that, you know, it's sucking resources out of the public. The counter argument is that if you have it, you're more likely to retain people and you depressurize the public system. There's pluses, minuses, but the point is we need to argue, we need to look at it. And I think it's time for that discussion to occur. That means looking again at the Canada Health Act.
So I've brought into the studio the Time to Talk Science and Medicine crystal ball, and I'd like to hand it over to you. And specifically thinking about that fourth tier of a citizen who hasn't got the funds or a primary doctor, what does your crystal ball tell you about how the future of Canadian healthcare is going to remedy these problems?
Well, of course, I don't have a crystal ball. Here's what I hope, and here's what I think. I really do think. I think that there are lots of very smart, well-intentioned people in this country who are very much aware of these issues. The fact that we have an accepted public system in Canada for healthcare is a tribute to the fact that the Canadian ethos is to ensure that everybody is taken care of. That's who we are as a country. We believe nobody should be left alone. We should help everybody. That's why we have taxation the way we are. That's what differentiates us as a country. I believe we still are that country. And I believe that the interest will emerge politically, and it will emerge from the grassroots to look again intelligently at how we're doing things. The Canada Health Act was last revised in 1984. It needs a refresh. It needs a thoughtful refresh, not to abandon the principles that everyone should be cared for, but to ask the question, how do we do that today with such drastically increased demands on our system and such incredible complexity in our medical care needs? How do we do it today? And we're smart enough to do that.
Okay, so thank you very much for answering our questions today. We really enjoyed your book, and we really enjoyed diving into kind of finding out what the problem is and possibly some of the solutions. Before we wrap the podcast up, though, we'd like to get to know you a little bit more, and we've got some slightly silly questions that we'd like to ask you. So I'll kick off and say, what is your favorite meal, and can you actually cook that dish yourself?
Oh, I have to weigh in. No, before he even answers, because if he says he can't, I'm going to have to call him out because we have a fruitcake competition every year.
Oh, wow.
And I can tell you that it's the only time Dr. Sanfilippo has ever appeared in the kitchen is for the fruitcake competition. So you go ahead and give your answer, Tony, but I'm going to be listening critically.
Well, the answer to the second part is no. Okay, so let's get that out of the way right away. My favorite meal, plank salmon. I love salmon, and my wife is a wonderful cook, and I love everything she makes. But the plank salmon she makes is really wonderful.
But can you cook it?
I can help
in a pinch.
I can find the plank.
Okay, Tony. Here's another challenging question. What type of music do you like? And parenthetically, can you tell us what your favorite musical instrument is?
Jazz. I like lots of different kinds of music, but I love what I call soft jazz, vocal jazz, the American Standard Playbook, and trombone is my favorite instrument.
And I understand you have a trombone yourself that you play.
Yeah, I have a trombone. I play it. I don't pretend to be a musician or good at it, but I enjoy it a lot. I get lots of satisfaction from my music and my instrument, and I'm not good, but I like it.
So if you could travel in time, would you go backwards or would you go forwards?
Well, I've always had an incredible interest in history. So while it's tempting to want to go forward and see where things are going to be, I have incredible interest in observing some great events of history and some great eras.
Anything spring to mind?
Well, I would love to be around at the time of Christ and hear some of his speaking and how he expressed his ideas to people at that time and in his language. I would love to have been in Abraham Lincoln's office around the time of the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation. I would love to have been around Winston Churchill. When he was deciding how to bring people through the Blitz in England. There are lots of periods of time where critical things happened, where having been there and seen what actually happened, undiluted by the interpretation of history, would be fascinating to me.
Okay, I have one final question. It's the most important question we asked all of our guests. If you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
Well, I guess I'd have to say Bugs Bunny, because his tagline was, "What's up?"
That's a great answer. Thank you very much. Dr. Sanfilippo, on behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to our audience today about your book and your thoughts on physician recruitment, training, and support. I think probably one thing that's kind of fallen out of reading your book and having conversations with you is the debt of gratitude that society actually has to physicians. And so, you know, thank you, physicians everywhere, and especially my general practitioner for their service. I'd also like to thank our listeners for taking the time to get to know Dr. Sanfilippo with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Dr. Sanfilippo's book, The Doctors We Need, is available for purchase at all good bookstores. We've already bought several copies, so you're off to a good start. If you're a student hoping to go into medicine, or if you're already training, this book should be on your reading list this year. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to know more about research at Queen's University, or to share this podcast, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts.